Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. What if MacGyver worked at NPR? He kinda does. Check out the How to Do Everything podcast with Mike and Ian. When you need to know how to find a date or find water in the desert, Mike and Ian are here for you. How to Do Everything is modern life lessons from NPR. Find How to Do Everything now at npr.org/podcasts. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we'll talk about Nick Hornby's novel, Funny Girl, and its story of comedy and television. Then we'll move on to film adaptations of novels and other books as well. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And Chris Klimek, what do you do when you are not here at NPR on Pop Culture Happy Hour?
I'm an editor at Smithsonian Air and Space Magazine and a contributor to various blogs, including the Monkey Sea?
That's right, the Monkey Sea. And all the way out on the West Coast, coming to us from NPR West, Barry Hardiman, what do you do at NPR?
I am an editor at NPR's Weekend Edition.
And as you may have noticed, our pal Stephen Thompson is kicking back in Austin. You may have heard about some of his Austin projects recently. He is making that trip at last, so we are always happy to have Chris and Barry with
He's
us.
He's neck deep in breakfast tacos.
That's right, he is. He is neck deep
so to speak.
In breakfast tacos.
How is he going to get his hair clean?
Well, yeah. And we are neck deep in fiction. Now, we wanted to get together and read a book, which is something that we decided we don't do enough, and we would do it while we had a moment here in the spring. And we picked Nick Hornby's Funny Girl. Now, if you know Nick Hornby, he is the writer of novels. I think of him as the writer of novels that have been made into movies I really like. Mm-hmm. He wrote High Fidelity. He wrote About a Boy. Fever Pitch, which mm-hmm. there was a British version of.
Let's not be confused about
this one. Well, he made, he wrote Fever Pitch, which in the British version, Colin Firth played a football fan. Mm-hmm. And in the American version, Jimmy Fallon played a Red Sox fan. Uh-huh. And I have seen both. So
that must be very, that's a Sophie's choice for you, I think.
Yeah, they're both charming in their own ways, although the Firth movie, I think, is probably better. At any rate, in this book, Nick Hornby deals with the history of kind of 1960s British sitcoms, mm-hmm. which is not a world that I admit I knew a whole lot about. And essentially his task is that he follows a comedy series from its inception through the process of getting it on the BBC, through its popularity, through its fade, and then through its time as a nostalgia property. And the central character after whom the book is named is a woman who originally she's named Barbara, but her name in most of the book is Sophie Straw, and she's the star of this comedy series. You meet her as a aspiring, unhappy beauty queen who goes and seeks her fortune, as they say, in making comedy. I'm going to start, actually, I think with Glenn, because I'm curious to hear how you reacted to this particular book.
I went through this thing in like an afternoon. This book goes down easy. It is largely dialogue, not to the extent of like the Armistead Maupin Tales of the City books, but almost to that point. Even though it's about the making of a television show, it never falls into the Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip trap by showing us the actual television show.
Right.
It takes the Dick Van Dyke Show approach, which is we never see the Alan Brady show that he works on. We just see them in the writer's room pitching ideas.
And you hear sometimes about specific scenes and specific exchanges.
You hear how it's received. You hear that it's funny, but we never get a chance to judge whether or not it's funny, which is so smart.
Right.
It leaves him to be able to do all these other things. This is a very British book in the sense that a lot of it's about the difference between people's inner lives and their outer lives. Everybody in this book wants to be kind. There's a gentleness to this book, and I think he approaches it by being very genial towards his characters. Even when there's disagreements in the writer's room, everything blows over very quickly. It's a light book. It's a very entertaining book. I wouldn't go as far as to call it a slight book, but man, it just went uneasy.
The ensemble in this novel, and I really think of this despite the fact that it's named after her, it's very much an ensemble piece in terms of these characters. You have a couple of writers that work on her show.
Tony and Bill.
You have Dennis, who is the producer of the show, and you have Clive, who is her co-star. So it's essentially her and four dudes. Barry, how did you like this book?
It is an incredibly consumable book, which is really the hallmark, I think, of Warren Beatty's writing. I mean, you can really, he is not a great script writer for nothing. He knows how to get it down. It was sort of a great workplace book. Mm-hmm. And I thought as I was reading it that I would love for, you know, that this was the closest thing in some ways to the great book about NPR in some ways that I'm hoping somebody will write, where there really is this discussion about what is comedy. They're making this product, which is this comedy. Sometimes it's made by people who actually maybe don't even like comedy. So this is something that sort of verges on trivial, which is something I think in many news organizations, we sometimes underrate, you know, our arts and comedy offerings. Anyway, I'm digressing. But the point is this, I thought he was very, very good at explaining that thing. When people are trying to make something that is funny, that are trying to create, you know, a relationship on screen that is very much unlike a relationship any of the people in the writer's room actually experience themselves, that sort of inner outer live thing. That was something that I really liked thinking about.
Chris, how did you like this book?
Yeah, I liked it a lot. I did feel like it sort of dissipates towards the end and ends up being a little less substantial than I'd hoped for initially. I loved it at the beginning, still liked it a lot at the end. This guy, Dennis, this BBC producer who has to sort of rein in Bill and Tony sometimes and, you know, is silently pining away for Sophie for much of the book. I think he's the closest thing to the sort of character that Nick Hornby made his reputation writing. When we get into his inner life, his anxieties about his marriage and his, you know, inability to catch Sophie's eye and all these things.
At one point it says, if during his engagement to Edith someone had tried to explain how lonely marriage could be, he wouldn't have believed it.
Yeah.
So he's a very lonely married guy.
I mean, I think he's one of the signposts for the, even though he's, I don't know, he's probably mid-30s maybe. I think he's slightly older than the other characters. He and Sophie go on a date to see Hair. That show is new, which is one of the you know, cultural signposts that we get in this thing. I think it's important that this, you know, starts out in, what, 63 or 64, and, you know, Britain is just coming out of rationing and all this deprivation that's the long hangover of World War II. So comedy probably did have to prove that it had some cultural importance at that time. And, you know, that comes through in sort of a nice revenge scenario when Dennis gets to eviscerate the snobby guy, Norman, I think his name is.
Vernon.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because you guys are bringing up some of the things that I found most satisfying about the book. Yeah. I think, as Barry points out, there is some really good thoughtful stuff in here about not just the relationship between art and entertainment, but the relationship between art and entertainment in a public media outlet. I mean, it's very specifically resonant for me in a lot of ways. There's a moment where this guy Vernon says, I love ordinary people individually. It's ordinary people en masse that trouble me. And in which he's kind of going on to say, like, they seem to just all fall for these big, ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And I felt sort of the warm embrace of somebody getting me. As I said on Twitter, I feel like Nick Hornby was reading my mail.
Yeah.
At the same time, I will admit, you know, I know Nick Hornby from writing, and he's written books with female central characters before or co-central characters before, but I know him from books about young dudes. And I have to say, for me, she is actually the least interesting person in this book.
I would agree.
She is, to me, a little underbaked. The only thing that you get through her that I think is really valuable is he's very emphatic about writing the fact that she is so infatuated with the idea of comedy and comedy people, and that once she gets into this environment, she just wants to be with them all the time.
Right.
And I think people who have ever hung around with comedy people, or even in any creative enterprise, understand that. That part I thought was really satisfying. But I have to admit, I felt like his writer's heart was with particularly three of these four guys, the two gay writers and Dennis, as opposed to really being with her. It doesn't mean I think he was intentionally neglecting that character. I don't think there's anything shameful about saying he vibes with a certain kind of guy. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. He's written some beautiful, rich books from that point of view. I'm just not sure I'm not sure he got this woman right in his mind quite.
I agree. And I found, and it was funny when it was over, I thought, you know, because the characters that I most like spending time with were Dennis and, you know, and I thought, and why is that? And it, she seemed just had to have a little bit of a Cypher quality, the quality of a lot of stuff is projected onto her.
Right.
But she herself didn't have that. That sort of solid ground. And, you know, there are a lot of the sort of faint feminism of, you know, the time and, you know, all of that is woven in. But I agree with you. For me, the characters that lived were the dudes as well.
Yeah.
Well, I think that she's a little bit more developed in the beginning when we hear about her, you know, memorizing entire episodes of I Love Lucy and stuff.
Yeah,
and that, like,
right.
Like that level of attention doesn't really continue. When Hornby's prior novel, Juliet Naked, came out in 2009, I think, I got to talk to him about that. You know, I asked him, I was like, the women in your books are always so much smarter than the men. Laura in High Fidelity mm-hmm. is, you know, you, as a reader, you can't fathom what yeah. she's doing with Rob in the first place. And mm-hmm. the characters
and in Rachel and About a Boy is like,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah, right. You know. And
they're
and
slightly fetishized, yeah.
That's the perfect word. Yeah, I don't think it's a failure of empathy. I think he's doing the best he can.
Right.
But that flaw remains.
What did he say?
You know, they were comic novels, and he's feels a lot better making fun of men.
Yeah, I get that. And I think, in a way, what I've always appreciated about his writing is that he is better than almost any kind of, to me, approachable novelist that I've ever read at both recognizing how deeply messed up and flawed people can be and yet generating enormous empathy for them.
Yeah.
Real kindness.
Particularly
yeah.
Rob in High Fidelity is a really uh-huh. unlikable dude in a lot of
yeah.
ways. And the fact that any part of you is still invested in kind of hoping that guy will get it right is, I think, a testament to Hornby's skill.
The writer Ethan Kanen famously says, the most important thing in fiction is a likable main character. And for the kind of fiction that Ethan Kanen writes and for the kind of fiction that Nick Hornby writes, that's absolutely true. I liked the ambivalence that he baked into the Sophie character because we get over and over again how beautiful she is, that she understands that she's beautiful, that she understands how lucky she is, and yet she feels ambivalent about it. That doesn't mean she's rejecting it. By any means, she's keeping it at arm's length, but she's holding on to it. Over and over again, we see how she sees that fame is absurd, but she's not about to do away with it.
Right.
That is a very fine line to tread. It's a trick. You basically make your character likable by having them acknowledge their gifts, acknowledge that there's something going on that they don't
part
really
of
have
this,
a part of.
Right.
Yeah, that entertainment mythology, you
yeah.
know, that she is like just fast-tracked, right? And I mean, at one point, I think one of the writers describes her as a beautifully gift-wrapped package.
Right. She is intelligent but not sophisticated. She is
right.
Not worldly, but she's in no way stupid. Again, really tough to do.
Yeah.
And I think it was, for me, it was a little bit more successful than I think you guys thought. But
yeah, I mean, I
didn't understand why this book was called Funny Girl when it should have been called The Show.
I agree. I think,
totally.
If you think you're going to be reading a book that is primarily about a woman, I think you may be disappointed. And
I thought it was going to be about Barbara Streisand.
But I think, you know, I do think there is a lot of successful material in here about not just that art versus entertainment mm-hmm. thing, but also the creative person's desire to be loved and to be respected. And there's a passage that I really loved when one of the writers, Bill, is starting to think the show is now popular, the show is now beloved, mm-hmm. and he begins to have this, to sort of use this word again, this ambivalence about their success. And it says, now they had grown fat on love, and Bill found himself looking enviously at the social realists and the surrealists and the experimentalists and the satirists who would always be scrawny and pale. Mm-hmm. And I think that is mm-hmm. such a, I mean, I think everybody has seen artistic people go through that cycle where they achieve popular fame and initially think that that's all that they want. And then you see that, like, but I also want people to respect me, and I also want to mm-hmm. be cool in a different way than popular.
Mm-hmm. And if this book was written by an American author, I think at some point maybe the main characters, as they're fighting over the show, as they're trying to make it, would get besotted by its importance. They would become self-important. They would think that what they're doing is great art, even though it's just a sitcom. But it's British. And there is this thing right. bred into the British character to not get too big for your britches. So there is pomposity, but it's always these guys looking out at other people being pompous. I don't think he has a pompous bone in his body, or at least he's deathly afraid of it. So he kind of keeps that reined in to a great extent.
Yeah.
But they're also writing a show that at its peak, more than half the country is watching.
Right.
One of the shows that they get jealous of is Till Death Us Do Part, which became All in the Family when it came over to the States. Steptoe and Sons became Sanford and Son when it came over to the States. I mean, that, so it's you're really getting the roots of a certain kind of social sitcom that deals with social issues in a way.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very, their relationship to that kind of comedy is very interesting because it's clear that at times they see their show as adventurous and at other times they see their show as meek in a certain way. And you brought up the fact that you don't actually ever get to see the show. And one of the things I think is so interesting about this, and we'll talk about this more when we talk about adaptations in a few minutes, but Hornby often writes these people who have a passion. And one of the things that I think is cool about the movie adaptation of High Fidelity, for example, is that you get to use music in the making of the movie. So his love of music is animated in a different way because you get to actually hear it. And there's a scene in the movie where Jack Black comes in and plays Walking on Sunshine in the record store.
Yeah.
That's in the book, and it's Walking on Sunshine in the book. But the way it feels when you see it in the film, I felt like I got a little more of what that was supposed to be. It's interesting to me to think, if they were to make this into a film, do you have to then see the show that they're making, and do you see whether it's funny? Because the book is often funny. There are parts of the book that I think are really funny. There's a bit where Clive, the actor, is arguing why he's too good-looking to play a virgin, which I thought was awfully funny, and the people's reaction to it was awfully funny. But I enjoyed the book, but in different ways, perhaps, than I was expecting.
It would not be possible for us to know, however funny or progressive the show was, we couldn't see it the way an audience in 1964 or whenever would have seen it. You know, so, I mean, I think he's wise to just elide it.
And another thing that I wanted to mention real quickly is that we did talk about some of the gender stuff in this book. I do think, although he doesn't dwell a whole lot on what it would have been like to be a woman in these comedy rooms, which is something I was interested in, but I don't know how much there is to say about it at that time.
Right.
There's a terrific part where they explain how these male writers can figure out what the male character should be, and they kind of think, if we can figure out the male character, we'll just kind of bring the wife along with this really well-developed female character that we don't entirely know what we're doing with yet. And I thought, that, I think, happens. And I think, or has happened.
And the dichotomy between the two gay writers, one who is attempting to live a heterosexual life and one who is very much not, that struck me as real for the time. And I liked that it was done with a light hand and it wasn't dwelled on too much. I liked Cavalier and Clay a lot until it became about that, and then it was kind of hard to get away from it. It felt like that was what the whole book was. I liked it early in the earlier chapters of that particular book when it was there. It was a thread, and here it's a thread, and it complicates the book, and it enriches it.
Yeah. If you read this book, come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH, or find us on the blog at npr.org, or tweet us at NPRPCHH, and tell us what you thought of the book. I think we all at least kind of generally recommend it as a fun, enjoyable read. So the other thing on our agenda today, we've been talking quite a bit about Nick Hornby. And as Chris was just mentioning, Nick Hornby, in addition to writing novels that have been adapted into films in some cases, also has done some screenwriting independently of his own novels. He wrote the screenplay of An Education, which is where a lot of people first saw Carey Mulligan. It's a story about another period piece about a young woman.
Almost the same period.
Yeah, I was just thinking the same thing. And he also wrote the screenplay for Wild, a movie from last year that I liked a lot, with Reese Witherspoon as the woman hiking the Pacific Crest Trail. And it's interesting because for me, I think Hornby's American reputation has been greatly burnished by the success of the film adaptations, particularly, I would say, High Fidelity and About a Boy.
Yep.
So this got us thinking a little bit about adaptations in general. And we are not trying to get our arms around adaptations of books going back to Gone with the Wind and that sort of thing.
Have you guys seen The Godfather? It's good. You should check it out. Check it out.
A successful adaptation of a novel.
I dare say. Better than the book.
We're going out on a limb. but we sort of wanted to talk about the kind of modern adaptation. And the movie of High Fidelity was in 2000. The movie of About a Boy was a bit later. Those are the kind of most straightforward versions of adapting a book, right? You have a novel. You tell the story of the novel in a film that pretty much follows the course of the book. About a Boy strays a little bit more, I think. But that's kind of a straightforward approach. But then there are a whole bunch of other approaches. Barry, you're a book person.
I'm a book person. The thing that I was going to point out, when the material is, say, not as good as Nick Hornby, there are times when a movie adaptation can really soar, like, quite far away. And I was going to talk about Twilight. I mean, it's like a solid B+.
Right. Whereas, and I think there are movies where I don't think this was actually the case with 50 Shades of Grey, but to be perfectly honest.
Oh, totally.
It is possible that if there are things that appeal to you about that story, you would have gotten over the quality of the prose, which is very, very difficult to get over.
Not dismal.
I would say more than in Twilight.
Twilight is perfectly, you know, I think serviceable for, you know, a certain younger set. And I think actually the movie actually does something kind of interesting. And this is where it's not just about screenwriters coming in and fixing things, or it's more about the fact that they had an actress who's incredibly charismatic and who was able to make what was essentially a cardboard person on the page,
right,
who was just, you know, really, really hoping that that cute guy in biology would eat her, into a person with real feelings, because Kristen Stewart is frankly a really good actress.
And I think, as you say, a charismatic
actress. She's Sophie Straw. She's bringing more to it than is on the page.
Exactly. And so that, I mean, is one of those examples. And I actually, what I would say too, is that I, you know, when you think about particularly books that have heroines that are treated badly in some way, which I would argue is, you know, Bella has a tough choice.
No, of course. Yes.
Coming up and a real tough pregnancy, if you remember. Often the movie version can do better. So I was going to also mention The Lovely Bones by Alice Siebold, which is a wonderful book. I don't know if you guys have read it.
Isn't that a Peter Jackson movie?
It was a Peter Jackson movie. And I think he actually got criticized a lot for it when it came out. But the book tells the story of a girl who is raped and murdered quite early on and then sort of watches the hunt for her killer from heaven. One thing that is really, really, you know, and this is just about what movies can do because, you know, they're visual, just being able to lay eyes on a character who is so young and has had this terrible thing happen. Like, I loved this book. I think she's a great writer. But the quality of the prose made her seem older than she was. The young woman who played the main character in the movie, Saoirse Ronan, is so wonderful and so young and doesn't have to take on the burden of the prose. So I think one of the things that I think is really great about, one of the things that a movie can do really well is sort of shed the problems of the prose, whether it be that it's cardboard or that it's maybe too good, which it kind of is in the case of The Lovely Bones.
I want to talk a little bit about that burden of the prose thing that Barry mentioned, because when I was at the Ira Writers Workshop, I was in Iowa. Bridges of Madison County, the film, came out. Mm. And a bunch of us got together because we had worked in bookstores and we would read each other passages of that book, which is that prose is not completely inept, but it ain't apt. It's not even remotely apt.
We did that at the Strand.
Absolutely. The blurb on the back of the book is grammatically and imagistically, it just doesn't work. Yeah. It's laughable prose. And so we all went in there. We had a few drinks. We got in there. We were like, yeah, this is going to be good. We had to admit about halfway in, this is not so bad. This is not a bad movie.
Well, when you populate it with really good actors and you manage to, as you say, get away from the burdens of the prose and emphasize the pieces of the story that appeal to people.
Mm-hmm. Right. But here, I come back to this a lot, which is the difference between what the screenwriter can do and what the director does.
Mm-hmm.
And
sure,
what Eastwood, as a director of that film, did was take the tone of the book, which is sloppy and salty and really, really manipulative, and just be Clint Eastwood all over it. Just turn it way down, make it dry and arid,
and
take all that emotion out of it.
And
what you're left with is a pretty straightforward story. My half-ass theory is that I got two lists here in front of me, one that says the book is better, one that says the movie's better. I argue that in many cases, when the movie is better, it's because there's a gradient that exists between the book and the screen, and the property increases, goes up a gradient of weirdness, for lack of a better word, becomes quirkier, becomes more idiosyncratic, becomes more stylized, becomes more visionary because you have the influence of the director there. So something that is mainstream or targeted to the mainstream becomes something completely different that actually some barriers to entry kind of creep in, and that's what makes it more interesting and enduring. Case in point, The Shining. Now, this is a classic example. Not to diss the book. Stephen King's book is fine, but it is of a piece with a lot of the other stuff he does. The Shining, the film, is so different and so of itself and so weird that it stands the test of time. Now, it's a lot like Stanley Kubrick films, but it's so weird. Another case in point is Starship Troopers, which was a very generic Robert Heinlein science fiction pro-military kind of book that becomes a blistering critique of exactly that military mindset when in the hands of Paul Verhoeven.
Among other things, you're then talking about a situation where you have two creative people with a distinct viewpoint, and when you take those two viewpoints, sometimes you get a stronger product than either one of them can create individually, because what you have in the case of The Shining, despite the fact that Stephen King later said, I don't like it, he changed certain things, what you have is really a kind of collaboration between Stephen King and Stanley Kubrick. And because they have such different ways of approaching material and because they both have things that they're really good at, you hopefully wind up with a little bit of both, as opposed to something like, I would say, Cloud Atlas.
Sure.
Where you wind up with kind of less maybe than the sum of the parts, like a little bit less than maybe the writer is capable of and a little bit less than maybe the directors are capable of.
Well, okay, so when doesn't it work? I would argue that when, in the transition from book to the screen, the filmmakers prize, we got to make this clear, we got to make sure that the plot works at the expense of tone. And that's what you lose in Cloud Atlas. You lose this beautiful sense, and it's largely kind of, you know, embedded into the prose that David Mitchell writes, but you lose the tone. Like, for example, The Golden Compass. That book is weird, idiosyncratic little book that is not necessarily meant for mainstream blockbuster success. And when you try to take it out, it goes down the gradient of weirdness to this big blockbuster kind of thing that it just, you don't have a vision behind it. The first Harry Potter films, with the Christopher Columbus Harry Potter films, don't actually pop because it's not boulderized, but it's flattened.
It's essentially a cover band.
Right. Yeah, yeah. You get to Cuaron in Prisoner of Azkaban, and all of a sudden you have this director with a vision, and that's exactly what you're talking about, these two visions coming together in a new way.
Yeah. Chris, what do you
think?
Well,
I think this can work both ways. I mean, I thought of High Fidelity to introduce this discussion because as of 2 weeks ago, I thought, well, that's a movie I like even better than I like it as a novel. And now as I've been reading the novel again, now I'm not so sure. But I do know I asked Hornby, you know, who we agree has been pretty well served by the movies, you know, what do you think the secret is? There have been so many books made into bad films. And he said, well, you know, you got to keep the writer close and let them be involved and let them know what you're doing. And that's one way to go. Glenn, I know, has talked on the show a little bit about Under the Skin. This is a Michael Faber novel that became a movie from Jonathan Glazer last year that I loved. And that's an adaptation where the novelist was not involved at all, where what you see on the screen is completely compelling and hypnotic and interesting. It's also, I don't know, like 10% of the book. It's hard to quantify. What there is, it feels fully developed and fully immersive. It is the same as the novel in terms of effect, totally different in terms of technique. The novel fills you in a lot more as to, you know, what this mysterious being who Scarlett Johansson plays is doing on Earth and what her purpose is. And these things are left pretty opaque in the movie.
It's interesting because when you say that Hornby brings up this idea of keep the writer close, keep the writer involved, it raises the question of when you're doing an adaptation, what's the task?
Right.
Is the task to represent the book and make a movie that is as much the book as possible? Or is the task to make a good movie that contains sort of the spirit of the book
seed
or
of
elements
book.
Of the book or the seed of the book, as Barry says, because there are times when you can wind up with a movie that's not the book but is a good movie. And I think in the case of the Hornby movies, they have been pretty well served by largely being the book. So the other thing that I was noticing as I was looking at About a Boy, the film, is that the directors and also part of the screenwriting team for About a Boy were Paul and Chris Weitz. And Chris Weitz is also the screenwriter of the Cinderella adaptation that I just saw that Kenneth Branagh directed. So you kind of have this guy who has worked in adapting all this different stuff. It's one thing to adapt Nick Hornby, and it's another thing to be working on like the adaptation of this super ancient, zillions of years old fairy tale. So it's interesting to see kind of the art of adaptation in a bunch of forms. But it does for me raise that issue of what the job is, because there are certain books wind up getting adapted in heavy quotation marks that I'm now making with my fingers, that really are, you know, like when they made the film of Moneyball, the film of Moneyball it's a narrative based on a nonfiction book.
Right.
And you can find that in certain other ones,
I think. Mean Girls?
About Mean Girls and other stuff.
Sort of an education, yeah.
Well, right. And, I mean, then there's this there is an entire strand of things that are just inspired by books that don't lend themselves to being movies. Like the fact that there's a film of Steve Harvey's Think Like a Man. There was a movie of What to Expect When You're Expecting.
Right.
Which is really
if you want to call it that.
And it's nothing but brand identity. You know what I mean?
Right.
It has nothing.
Yeah.
It's not the book.
No, you're paying for a title. And
you're just paying for the title.
Right.
The same thing was true of He's Just Not That Into You. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of lashing the book brand to the film. Mm-hmm. And so you have everything from really super faithful adaptations to things that barely have anything to do. I would say I didn't see the Steve Carell film of Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day, but it certainly did not appear to be the book, which was sad to me.
The film can also provide a service. The Lord of the Rings films, for example. I read those books every year for many, many years. Tolkien was first and foremost a linguist, so he loved archaic words. He loved arcane words. And he loved describing the landscape, but he'd use these weird words like scarp and scree and escarpment. And we didn't have, we had like a little, Target dictionary in our house that didn't have words like that. So a lot of this book was just going past me every time I would read it. The entire chapter of Helm's Deep in the second book in The Two Towers takes place. It's this massive battle. Every year I'd get to it, and I couldn't picture it in my head for $1 million, so I would skip it every single time because I know who won. And seeing it in the film was this revelation because it's so complicated, and the landscape is everything. It says it is providing a vital service of bringing this thing to life in a way that you will now, whenever I read that,
and you know, I've talked many times on this program about the fact that I sadly could never really get into the Lord of the Rings, and I really didn't get it until I saw the movie version. God bless Peter Jackson. And now, and I have to say, he also does that vital service at the beginning of the first movie of sort of crunching the history in a really digestible way.
Right. And also, as you mentioned before, a performance can bring it up. The Devil Wears Prada, good book.
Oh, totally.
The Devil Wears Prada, great movie, because of Meryl Streep bringing that character, popping it off the page.
That's a good example of where it's a pretty accessible book and it's a pretty accessible movie. But I think the movie is a better version of that story in some ways than the book is for exactly the reasons that you mentioned. And I sometimes think that movies are particularly useful at bringing out subtleties in interesting genre fiction, almost more than they are at improving upon literary fiction. Because some of some of the kind of most self-consciously literary, and I don't mean that in any kind of negative way, self-consciously literary stuff that I've seen adapted into films can be really complicated to make that transition. There's a film that Kristen Wiig was in called Hate Ship, Love Ship, which is based on an Alice Munro. Short story. But the entire point, it's a short story, and the entire point to me of this Alice Munro story is what is elided, that you see these people up to a point and then you pick them up again. And what has happened in that gap is the entire point of the story.
Right.
The unknowability of what's in that space is the entire point of the story. But when you take a short story and you make it into a feature film, all of a sudden you wind up telling the entire story of everything that happened, how they got from point A to point B. And then you think, that's not what that's supposed to be.
Right.
And it's wonderful, as Barry says, wonderful material. But the question becomes, is film as good at bringing something new out in something literary as in something genre? But I would be interested to hear what folks have to say about that. So again, come and find us on Facebook or on the blog and let us know what you think. And that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
A new comic book series from Image Comics called Bitch Planet. It is by Kelly Sue DeConnick and with art by Valentine Delandro. It is a bracingly, matter-of-factly feminist take on the women in prison exploitation genre, shot through with kind of a science fiction lens. Image Comics describes it over and over again. You'll see this all over the web as Margaret Atwood meets Inglourious Bastards. And I cannot dispute that characterization. So in the future, women, calm down, Barry. In the future, women who do not conform to paternalistic norms are sent to an outer space prison colony. And the great thing about this book is they show you around the edges of the action how these norms are enforced through media, through advertising, through television. So it's doing what science fiction is really great at doing. It's taking a lot of subtextual, cultural elements of the present day and making them concrete and very, very literal, and then stepping back and seeing how different is it really than what we're dealing with now. That is very tricky to do because it can come off as didactic and shrill. We want satire like this to nudge us in the ribs, not poke us in the ribs. It's very, very important, but this book is so sly and smart, and the first issue is it feels like it's on rails to take you to a very specific place that you've been to before, and then all of a sudden it is very, very not. So it's great. Bitch Planet by Kelly Sue DeConnick and Valentine Delandro.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Chris Klimek, what is making you happy this week, bud?
Well, Linda Holmes, Glenn Weldon, Barry, especially you and I go way back. You know me. You know I'm a man who lives by a code. No treadmills and no video games. Well, like any criminal in any crime movie ever, I have renounced my own code. And I, so far, am getting away with it. I broke down. I bought a video game. There is a video game based on Alien, the first one, called Alien Isolation. Two words that mean almost the same thing. They went all in on this one. This is recreating the production design of the movie. They got Sigourney Weaver to record some voice stuff, and I couldn't help myself.
No,
partially because I have not played a video game in 20 years. I am just astonished by the leap in sophistication that video games in general have acquired. It's
come a long way since Pong.
Yes, it really has. It was Blip the last time. But you know, so the premise: you're Ripley's daughter, mentioned in a deleted scene from Aliens, who grew and lived her life while she was floating around in her space capsule after Alien. So you have chosen work in the sector of the galaxy in which your mom disappeared, and you're trying to find the flight recorder from the ill-fated starship Nostromo.
As you would.
And you end up on this abandoned space station where the social contract has broken down out of fear of this horrible killing machine that is stowing away in the air shafts that we know what it is, but they don't necessarily know what it is. This is a survival game. You can't kill the alien. You have to hide from it. The alien is programmed to be very smart. It'll hunt you. It never shows up in the same place at the same time. It learns from each of your encounters with it. You know, so you have to be crafty and build tools and devices to help you survive. There are other hazards. It's a stealth game. You have to outwit and elude the alien. You also are sometimes in conflict with frightened looters and human survivors on the station, but you don't have to kill them. You can get through this game without, you know, fake killing any fake people.
That's good.
Which I appreciate.
Sure.
And so far, I have not lost my job or any friendships over having playing this video game, perhaps because I can't really bear to do it for more than a half an hour at a time because it's too scary.
So you've broken your own code.
So I would say that the virtues of restraint and temperance and self-control are what's making me happy this week. But there is one other more substantial thing. Jessica, if you could please play clip number 3.
I was raised in a small town in East Tennessee, population 2,500. I was raised by a pack of passive-aggressive Southern women. Yes, it's true. They taught me to say things like, "Oh, you're wearing that." Again. Bless your heart.
This is the voice of the great Kevin Boggs, who, at least among a community of storytellers and creative people here in D.C. who were early adopters of the show, is a much, much beloved figure. He, the whole time I knew him, he's a friendly acquaintance, not a super close friend of mine, made his living working in restaurants, but what he loved to do was tell stories on stage, sometimes act in plays, but storytelling is what he really devoted himself to, and he gave classes and sort of this and this sort of thing through an organization called Speakeasy DC, and was great at it, and was a big believer in that learning to tell a story was a way of mastering any experience that had haunted you, no matter how painful it was. And he was incredibly generous and fearless in, you know, mining his own life, his own painful experiences, whether it was, you know, coming out or dealing with depression, or and turning these into really, really entertaining, illuminating stories. And he was, with very shocking swiftness, diagnosed with liver cancer and died just on Friday, 4 days ago, as we're recording this. Kevin is not famous, you know, doesn't even have the cultural footprint of like Mike Daisy or a Sandra Singh Lo,
right,
or
sure,
people who do this, but I think he's as good as any of those folks. And his videos are on YouTube. If you go there and type in Kevin Boggs, B-O-G-G-S, and Speakeasy, you will find 6 or 8 of his best stories for you to enjoy. None of them are longer than like 8 or 10 minutes. And whether you knew him or not, it would be a really, really great way to remember the generous storyteller, Kevin Boggs. Cool.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Chris. I appreciate that. Miss Barry Hardiman, what is making you happy this week, ma'am?
Well, this week, a couple of things are making me happy, but the one that I really want to talk about, and I don't know if you guys are fans of this one, but I really am worried that not enough people are watching The Americans, which is, I think, a very, very fine television program. And, you know, I finally got all caught up with it last night, and I thought, I think it is so clever and so wonderful. It's in its third season, but it is absolutely worth catching up. So the background on this, if you haven't caught the first 2 seasons, Philip and Elizabeth Jennings are Cold War spies living lives, secret lives. They're Americans. They have an entire American family. They have 2 kids. Their kids do not know that they are Russian spies. And this season has gotten really, really interesting, I think. And in every episode, the family dynamics also sort of inform the spy dynamics. And great soundtrack, really great use last night of the Rumors, Fleetwood Mac's iconic Rumors album. Really great spy scenes, one including some dental work, which was really kind of crazy. Fabulous love story, but like, you know, with good icky spy stuff. It's a slow, slow burn. It's funny, my husband said to me last night, he was like, you know, for a spy story, the pace is fairly slow, but I think it is a real burn. And I think it's fabulous. I will say also, just because I know, Linda, this is your friend, last night was fairly confusing that at one point I said, my God, I have to go to the Seppenwall.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Who is recapping it quite wonderfully.
My
and
dear,
but I really, you've got to do it.
Seppenwall, always a good source for this kind of thing.
It's a great show, Barry. I have not caught up on the 3rd season yet. I was getting a little dismayed toward the end of the 2nd season because the Paige storyline didn't seem to be going anywhere, and she was uninteresting. And I think at the very end of the 2nd season, they found a way to make her interesting. So
it is
paying
off.
Forward to it.
So good. I highly recommend that. I will also, just on a lower brow note, that I'm really, really psyched that Southern Charm is back for its 2nd season. And that's all I want to say about
that's
that.
That's a Bravo show, right?
Oh, could it be anything else?
No, it really couldn't be.
Well, I love it.
Well, thank you very much, Barry Hardiman. I got 2 quick things. One is that I was sitting around watching TV just last night as we taped this, and realized that if I have nothing else to do, I will watch a bunch of episodes of Castle until I pass out.
Oh!
And I'm not sure that I've ever spoken about my great affection for Castle, which is an ABC show starring Nathan Fillion. And it is a show that I have always liked but never made a rule of watching every week. It's one of those things that I just watch long chunks of when it's on TNT, and I will just sit there and just absorb it until I lose consciousness.
Until you lose consciousness, right.
Yeah. It's a man and a woman who solve mysteries and crimes. And it goes back to not just moonlighting, but it goes back to like Scarecrow and Mrs. King and Remington Steele.
Nick and Nora.
Yeah. It's all basically the same show, but it's a really nicely executed version of this show. I find it consistently funny. I find it consistently free of self-seriousness. So my recommendation this week for something to just stumble across on cable is Castle. The other thing I want to mention quickly, I promise this is the last time that I will mention that I spent a lot of time last week researching Cinderella. Mm-hmm. And the best thing that came out of that was that I discovered that the Rodgers and Hammerstein Cinderella with Julie Andrews from 1957 is on DVD, which it wasn't for a very, very long time. It is on DVD. Everything makes Barry squeak is a positive thing.
Oh my God, can you hear me typing it into the internet on my phone right now?
And
where
can I get it? Yeah, well, and I got
it
from Amazon and they sent it to me and I was able to watch it. This was something that they wrote for television. It was not a stage show that they adapted, but something they wrote to be on television, starring Julie Andrews substantially prior to Mary Poppins and her film career. You know, most people saw this in black and white. It was a TV event. It was watched by like 100 million people, had an enormous audience. It has a several, despite my love of musicals, I had forgotten how many good and lovely songs there are in this piece. Mm-hmm. I very much enjoyed watching it. The stepsisters are Alice Ghostly and Kay Ballard.
There you go.
It's oh my God.
Doubling down.
The prince is John Cypher, who later was a soap opera actor. Oh, and it's, I mean, it's...
Accuracy in naming.
It is really, really fun. And I was really glad to find it. And of all the things that this research into Cinderella brought me, actually watching the old black and white Julie Andrews Cinderella might have been my favorite thing. So that is what is making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon. You can follow Chris at CT Klimek, K-L-I-M-E-K. You can follow Barry at B Hardiman, H-A-R-D-Y-M-O-N. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, R-E-E-D-Y, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are bobbing your head to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. What if MacGyver worked at NPR? He kinda does. Check out the How to Do Everything podcast with Mike and Ian. When you need to know how to find a date or find water in the desert, Mike and Ian are here for you. How to Do Everything is modern life lessons from NPR. Find How to Do Everything now at npr.org/podcasts.